everyone, and welcome to the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Woodzik, and my pronouns are they, them, and theirs. This is episode 160 with Rodney Lizcano. Rodney is a prolific actor and director whose work you may have seen on stages in Colorado, Florida, and beyond. We talk about the Laramie Project, Shakespeare, and his upcoming run of Noises Off at the Arvada Center. He'll be playing the role of Freddy. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy episode 160 with Rodney Lizcano. I am thrilled to welcome to the podcast the man, the myth, the legend, Rodney Lizcano is here. Welcome, Rodney.
Friends, hi, Woodzik. Thank you for having me.
So we were talking before we started recording about Shakespeare in Florida in the winter. So you've just returned from a run at Orlando Shakes. Tell us all about it.
Sure. I just finished a original practice production run of Henry VI, Part One, the Joan of Arc series. But my history with the theater goes way back into 2017, when I was first invited to join the acting company of Antony and Cleopatra. This was BC before COVID times. And I've done a lot of Shakespeare in Colorado. And I was, you know, and as you work in theater and regional theater, you're accessible to a lot of directors nationally. And so they brought in a director from Florida by the name of Jim Helsinger, who is the artistic director at Orlando Shakespeare Theater. And so he came out to Colorado Shakes twice, which is where we first met. And hopefully, as you do, you get along, you like the director, you like the POV, you like how he directs, you like his Shakespeare attitude, all that. And he invited me to his theater back in 2017, which I graciously accepted. I'm so glad I did, because that's turned into such a great artistic collaboration and friendship. So since 2017, I've been back to Florida for about six seasons. And typically his programming happens in winter. His Shakespeare shows happen in winter. It's not a full, so they do musicals, children's plays, new work, and Shakespeare. But his Shakespeares are produced mostly around the beginning of the new year. So January, February, March is where they slot their Shakespeares, which is great for me. Because most of my Shakespeare stuff, the bulk of my Shakespeare stuff happens in the summertime. So it's a win-win situation. So yeah, I've been back there for about six seasons. They are now producing... They just finished doing the Henry ad. So we did Richard II, Henry I, parts 1 and 2, Henry V. And we just started the War of the Roses. And he's going to finish producing that through Richard III. And that will take the next two seasons. So fantastic, right? I love, who knew that I would be doing history plays? I always consider myself a comedic Shakespearean actor. And now I'm now hitting the histories really, really hard, which is fantastic. I think everyone should have that balance of, you know, comic chops and then speak the speech.
Absolutely. For folks who aren't familiar with original practices, because I wasn't until my time at CU Boulder and with CSF, it is so flipping cool. And as someone who is, I would consider, a well-educated, well-rounded theater person, I was kind of aghast that I didn't run across this until grad school. So can you set the stage for what those conditions are?
Sure. And I hope I don't misspeak, because it's my assumption that original practices style has always existed, but really only became popular, I would say, in the last 5 to 7 years. Although American Shakespeare Company does this. This is how they do their shows at American Shakespeare Theater. They do an original practice, no director. I think at some point someone said, I think we can do that at our theater. And let's try it. And let's throw spaghetti on the wall to do this process. But the process is, the concept is, Shakespeare's company would have known and had all the canon already under their belts. So it was really just a matter of remounting the play. And remounting the play meant minimal rehearsal. Meant no director, right? They had an actor manager, which was typically, you know, Burbage was that role in Shakespeare's time. But at least someone to say, all right, we're doing this today, we're doing this today, we're doing this tomorrow, let's all piece it all together. And so it really is going back to the roots of original Shakespeare of how they would remount the production. And it varies from theater to theater. So, for example, one theater, we have 20 hours to put on a show. I just finished doing this one and we had about 52 hours, which you think, that's not a lot of time for a history play because it, it's dense. So though some of those plays are really dense, and it requires rehearsal and it requires an unpacking with a director and a dramaturg and collaborating with your actor and saying, I think this is what it wants to be. So while it's quick and dirty, the quick and dirtiness of it makes you make bold choices, which is what we always want in theater. Bold choices, quick choices. And then in the playing and the rehearsing of it, you find out, oh, that might not have been it. And so the discovery is really on your feet. Your R&D, your research and development really then becomes on your feet. And then it's the swiftness of it. There's a lot of people who don't like this process. It took me a while to get on board of it because I love to unpack. I love dramaturgy. I love sitting at the table for days on end, because if I understand the play, then my heart understands how to portray the scenes or where we think it lives comically or tragically, or what's the rhetoric, what's Shakespeare saying. I now love the process. I love the process when I'm able to do it with people who already know the why and the how, and there's less questions and there's more yes and attitude. And so the play just starts picking up. It's like, oh my God. I mean, I'm blown away when there's instances where it's like a two-hander or a three-hander Shakespeare scene. And those actors have come prepared and those actors have kind of unpacked it. And then they just start talking to each other. And it is improv. It feels like improv, but it's not. You're just reacting and listening in the moment. And that to me is fascinating work. So I've grown to love it. I'm now part of, I would say, two major Shakespeare companies who practice this as a part of their season. That's Colorado Shakespeare Festival and Orlando Shakespeare Theater, who always have this programming as a part of their season. So it's a good muscle. It's a good muscle for me in this part of my career to say, hey, can I still do this? Do I have that agility? Do I have the brain space to do this? I'm so set in my ways, I think, in my process about, I know I get a script, you read the script, you table it, you do this. But to be thrown in the deep in end of the pool at this stage of my career, it's always a good shot in the arm. It's a reminder that I still have that agility as an actor, hopefully.
It's good to stay nimble and to stay curious. And I don't think I've shared this on the podcast before, but when I understudied with CSF, I got to see that original practice. This would have been the summer of Twelfth Night and Romeo and Juliet a few summers ago. And to give half the audience one flag of one color, the other half the other, it had the energy of like a Super Bowl game, like the Super Bowl of theater. The audience, I've never seen an audience so engaged. So just to shout out to everyone, if you haven't seen an original practices Shakespeare, that's gotta be part of your theatrical bucket list.
Especially at Colorado Shakes, right? That amphitheater holds 1,000 people. You give the audience a symbolic white rose and a red rose, and then it becomes, sometimes it feels like gladiator, actor gladiator school, where the audience doesn't necessarily want you to fail. They want you to succeed, absolutely, but they understand the concept that anything can happen. And then the audience, we always try to engage the audience with direct address. But in the original practices, we encourage them to be a part of the show, to react, to be those groundlings, too. Thank God they don't throw fruit at us, but to really be a part of the show. And that I've learned has been, that's why people keep coming back to this type of program.
Right on. And before we leave Florida, I just want to ask, I'm so curious about Shakespeare in Florida. In my mind, those are two things that are perhaps incongruous. What are the audiences like? What kind of reaction do you get by performing Shakespeare in Florida?
This is fascinating, and I think I've wrapped my mind around Florida. Florida is rich with culture and talent, especially Orlando. Orlando's an interesting pocket because you've got Disney and you've got Universal Studios, so people are attracted there for that. But the talent pool in Orlando is serious. It is high notch. They are triple threats. They can sing, they can dance, they can act, they can talk Shakespeare. Because it, I mean, their acting pool is huge. I mean, you think about Denver, whose market is, it's modest, but there's a richness of talent. And I've seen it through my friends who are part of regional theater there, who are also educators, and their arts programs start really early in elementary school, junior high school, high school. It's rich. I mean, it's comparable to, I grew up in Texas, which you also think the South. You think football, Friday Night Lights, but it's equal. The arts and football and sports, let's just say as a whole, are really, really quite thriving in those kind of states. Florida is not the exception. And so I'm thrilled to report that the arts are alive there. It's just you kind of go, huh, until you know. And people are, they love the Shakespeare there. They have their main collaborator with their education is the University of Central Florida. So like any other program, they train and invite actors to be part of their Shakespeare company. And I think that's really, really important to, not forget a generation of actors who also enjoy doing Shakespeare, who also are enthralled by classical work. So yeah, I had that same kind of going, huh? This happened. So, but I'm happy to report that, yeah, you spent any time there, you'd be like, wow, this is encouraging. This is encouraging to see that the arts are so alive in that area. And Shakespeare specific, right? You can go, yeah, musical theater. I mean, you can go down to anywhere. You can go to Naples, you can go to Coconut Grove, you can go to St. Augustine. They have so many theaters in Florida. So many theaters in Florida and regional theaters and community theater, all types of theater are being produced there. So I'm happy to report that.
Thanks for reporting out. And so next time y'all go to Disney World, check to see what other performances you can see in Florida. So now we're going to move
1,000%.
from Florida to Colorado. This past fall, you co-directed the Laramie Project at Arvada Center, and I'm a big fan of theaters who hear some feedback and make an adjustment. And so, can you talk a little bit about that casting process and then what rehearsal and performances were like?
Sure. I have to start out with a huge shout out to the Arvada Center for choosing this show into programming. Who, if you're not aware, it was a risk to produce this show at this theater, and only for the fact is that their audiences are used to more classical work. Definitely musicals, are their bread and butter. So to produce this work was a risk, but it was an important risk, and I'm glad they took it because in the end, it resonated much more than anyone had anticipated. So I just want to start off by just saying thank you, Arvada, for taking that risk in a world that needs more theaters to do so. And I hope they continue. The process was long and swift. this was my first time co-directing a show, so it was very, very important that me and my co-director Kate Gleason had an outline of how we wanted to approach this dual leadership role, and we felt we as we chatted, we both felt we had certain strengths, right? We both know we can block a play, right? We weren't going to say you're going to block act one, you're going to block act two. That didn't feel cohesive. What we quickly learned is that I am such a visual person. I'm a visual artist. I'm a visual director. And we were lucky enough to have, as part of our design concept, a projection landscape that helped us tell the story of not only Matthew Shepard, but the town of Laramie, Wyoming, which is, the bulk of the play is really about the people of the play. Matthew Shepard was the catalyst of the play, but the play truly is about the community repairing this tragic event that happened. So it turned very quickly into me curating the images, choosing which images were going to work well in moments, a visual soundscape as well. And then that's how I chose to do my leadership role there. I was like, this jazzes me. I know I'm going to be fulfilled and thrilled to do this. I was also part of the acting company too. So there was a How do I balance myself in already very deep-rooted work about a real person, about real crimes, about real hate, about real communities being affected, right? And so I needed to say, okay, I am allowing myself to have a cap, right? And not overextend myself. And then it naturally happened that Kate Gleason is just, she's just an actor's director. She ended up blocking the whole show, which was great because I was on stage. There's no way I can split myself that way. I can't be on stage and look at the stage pictures. So then that naturally became, she's like, all right, Kate is going to do the majority of the blocking. I will do more, I can't say technical heavy director, what a director would handle or technically. But that kind of naturally happened. So it was very much simpatico. Our collaboration was really great that way. And then when I could give an acting adjustment, because I'm also the co-director, is that I was also allowed to filter my observations through Kate. And Kate mostly had the talking stick. Right. Because I've been directed by two people too. And it's like, okay, who do you want to listen to? So it's really important to filter the information through one person. And so that was also important for us to have that trust with the acting company, is that you're not getting information from two people. It'll be filtered through one. And so it never felt, I hope it never felt like there was two big parents in the room, but hopefully just one big caring parent. Casting was swift as well. We did one round of I wasn't part of the general auditions. Then we had a group of invites to come. And then as a queer artist, I saw a little bit of lack of representation. So it was important for me to see more people from the community in the room. And so it was decided that we would open up another general audition to the LGBTQ plus community and see what kind of interest was there. It was very important for me as a director to hear these words come out of queer mouths. It's in the community of Laramie was not queer, but it was important for me as a perspective to see it's like, can these words resonate through the mouths of people who have experienced the hate, who have experienced the trauma, who have experienced these slights from their own communities? And so that's always the goal, right? The goal is always to have inclusivity. You can talk about, I want 50%, I want 80%, I want this and that. And that, while is a great goal, never quite happens. But it was very important to me to invite as many queer artists to the table. And they came in droves. We had a really great callback weekend. We saw artists we had never seen before, and definitely the Arvada Center had never seen before. I had a periphery because I'm friends with people in the community, but I saw people I had never seen before. And that was fantastic to see. It's like, okay, there's the interest, and they will come with an invitation. And I hope that it doesn't take having an invitation for having those artists come into a room. So from there, we had a company of eight truly wonderful actors from all walks of life, from all identities, races, to help tell this story. And that was truly a fantastic experience. We were very fortunate enough to have Judy and Dennis Shepherd attend the show twice and speak at the Arvada Center at, unfortunately, the 25th anniversary of commemorating Matthew Shepherd. So it was a big year. It was a big month. It was an emotional month. But in the end, such a gratifying time to present this work. A lot of my work recently has, I can't say that I chose to do it, but it somehow has happened. And I don't want to keep going on the train, but doing theater as activism has been really, really important to me in the last couple of years, especially since 2020, that while theater is entertaining, it can be sort of activism. We can change the needle. We have, as artists, have always had that voice because we are out in public to tell these stories. So I hope it continues. I hope it continues. I'd love to continue to work on this type of material that's important to tell.
I really appreciate you sharing, talking about wearing those two, doing those two roles of co-directing and acting and setting those boundaries for your energy. One of the things that I like to ask folks who are involved with theater as activism, what's your self-care practice? How do you nurture yourself after expending emotional labor on top of the artistic energy of acting or directing? And I ask this because I think we all need more tools in our toolbox on this front.
Absolutely. I mean, in any context, we can be telling stories about violence, right? We can tell stories about extreme emotional and mental states, right? And that's how we say, how do you take it? What's the self-care? And I think it's different for everybody. For me, I have to create an X amount of time to step out of the process and say, this is what I'm doing. This is not truly what defines me. And I also need to be sure that I can also be as successful to my home and my partner and my family and not have those things resonate through my personal life, right? So that becomes very important. Don't bring your work home is very important, because then there's no respite. You're consistently thinking and feeling the world of the play. So for me, that comes into taking very long walks with my dog. That turns into reading fiction, right? Completely changing the world and where I'm currently in, reading a lot of fiction. And then for me, it's really putting in some earbuds and going on a run and just meditating. For me, running is meditating, which is weird. People think about sitting,
Yeah.
still. And so, but for me, meditating is really, really running. That's where my brain can kind of slow down when my body, I don't know, you exhaust the body and then you think the brain will rest afterwards. That's kind of where I live, which is weird. I'm that person that takes a 20-minute hot shower. I do the most of my thinking in the shower. I do a lot of, debriefing in the shower. I do a lot of debriefing and meditating while I'm on a treadmill or while I'm running. And then I talk with my partner. I talk with my partner and get their perspectives. I think it's you can't walk through this alone. I'm lucky to have a partner who can say, "How was your day? Do you want to talk about it?" And respects that if I don't, and then recognizes that if I do, there's a safe space for me to do that with.
Aw, it makes my heart happy. And speaking as an Europa grad, there's no one right position in which to meditate. And so if you're listening to this and you're like, oh my gosh, I can't sit still and meditate, cool. Like you can walk, you can lie down, you can do whatever works for you, running, treadmill, like make the body, comfortable to be mindful. Like there are no rules.
There are no, and I think that's such a Colorado thing, right? It's like you always say, "Hey, let's go for a hike." That's such part of our culture here. And yes, I can hike and meditate. I can hike in a beautiful landscape and just be. Create those safe spaces wherever you live, wherever it is. It's important to carve that out. To say, "I don't have time to." You have to make time for it. You must make time for it. There are 12 hours in a day and, 30 minutes, 20 minutes. It's just self-care is so important. It is so important.
If Elmo has taught us anything this week, right? I don't know. Have you heard of the Elmo drama, Rodney?
I have not. No. All right. I'm writing it down. I'll see it. I'll take a look. What do you
It's
have a recap of Elmo
I
today?
will give you the Cliff Notes, which is we're recording this on February 2nd, so it's Elmo's birthday today as we're recording. Beginning of the week, Monday, Elmo tweets, "How's everybody doing?" The internet trauma dumps on Elmo. The social media people at Sesame Street put out mental health resources. The rest of the Sesame Street crew jumps in. Snuffleupagus talks about how he's grateful to have big ears to hear people's big emotions, etc. That's like really cool and would have been a great narrative trending topic on its own, but it escalates because Elmo was a guest on the Today Show on Thursday, separately booked, Larry David. Larry David decides randomly improvising, shocking the hosts to go over and throttle Elmo on live television. And then the Today Show makes Larry David apologize to Elmo later on in the show. So self-care is indeed important and also is recognizing one's physical boundaries. I am going to make a really funny transition into this because Larry David was bullying Elmo in that moment, was he not? And we're going to transition now to Colorado Shakespeare Festival. One of the coolest programs I've ever come across is the violence prevention in the schools program. So maybe let's start off with your educational work with CSF, and then later we'll talk about more of your on-stage work.
Sure. Well, I was very fortunate to, as one of some of my first directorial work was to work with Colorado Shakespeare Festival's Violence and Prevention Program. And these are programs that these are truncated versions of Shakespeare with minimal casts that are shortened in length to tour schools around Colorado and use Shakespeare as the catalyst and the voice as to the how and the why, right? It's very important to recognize in daily life those areas of potential hate crimes or seeing people who bully each other, but then also advocate for what we call upstanders, that if you're still not the person that's receiving the bullying or the violence, that you have an opportunity to play a role and say, I'm going to help an individual. I am going to help use my voice. I'm going to use my voice in addition to wrong a right. And who doesn't need that in everyday life? And I think that's great to teach in school, which unfortunately is where we see the most of this type of behavior, of bullying at any level, bullying at any degree. And so these are truncated versions. These are 30, 45-minute versions of Shakespeare's plays played by 3 to 4 actors. So these actors play 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 roles swiftly and quickly. And it comes down to a really swift edit as where we can highlight that example of violence in world or how it is being showcased. So the show that I directed was Twelfth Night. And so we can say, oh, well, the character of Malvolio certainly gets a lot of that aggression, right? And then we found out that Sir Andrew also gets a lot of that in a micro version through Toby. While we say they're best friends, he gets a lot of microaggressions from a seemingly best friend. And so we present the play. And then afterwards, those actors do a workshop with the students and say, all right, did you see this? How could this have been handled? How would you intervene? How would you say stop? And so it's a lot of we're going to show you the work and then we're going to talk about the work. And then hopefully those little golden nuggets of information and seeds get planted, and we create more upstanders in the world, right? We create more day-to-day allies in the world. And so that people hopefully feel safe walking around the space on this planet.
I love that in the workshop aspect where, the program is set up to empower, to give these kids autonomy to come up with a solution and then not only come up with that idea, but get on their feet and then say those words, see what that would feel like. Because I feel in schools, there's so much social pressure. And so even being able to take 1 minute to practice what that might feel like, because I think sometimes there's the bystander effect, right? Like no one's doing anything. And so I'm afraid to do something. So to be able to create a safe space where even if the, solution is, hey, Sir Andrew, would you like to go get ice cream with me? Like a lot of, when I facilitated some of the workshops, a lot of the solutions were food-based and honestly, more power to the kids. Like that's a powerful thing to instill those skills, especially at a young age.
No, I agree. I agree. More upstanders as opposed to bystanders, right? One is active, one is passive. Let's create more of those individuals in the world, right? And that's a trait that if you learn early, you take on through the rest of your life, and then we become more passionate, empathetic adults, hopefully.
We can only hope, right? Let's now transition to your work on the other side of the table with CSF. By now, you must be in like dozens of roles that you've played for CSF, if my maths are correct, or close to it.
Well, I've been there for about 10 seasons now, and the bulk of my work has been they hired me as a clown. But I no longer play clown roles, which is fascinating because I would too also be a little, I wouldn't have, feel as fulfilled or stretched as an actor if I could do those because there's only a handful of clowns and you're going to hit them again. And, then you go, oh, I'm repeating a show, I'm repeating a character, I'm repeating something. So they've been really great as to stretching me as an actor in a way that other theaters haven't. CSF has been really good to me in the sense that it's almost like graduate school or any other program where it's like, we know your lane and you're really good in this lane. What if you tackle this material and we'd like to see your Richard the Third, which is what they asked of me. And I go, I never saw myself as a Richard the Third, but they did, because to some degree, they're like, we think Richard is somewhat of a clone. We think Richard is has that capacity, which he does. He talks to the audience. He gets them on their side, even though he's a villain, and then tells the audience what he's going to do, does it, and then recaps it to the audience to say, wasn't that great? Did you just see what I just did? And so that's it's really, really fascinating. Yeah, I love continuing to growing with them. They were able to give me my first professional directing job as well. So the relationship is not just actor producer. It now turned into director as well. So I love growing with an institution. That's always the goal, is to continue to grow with anyone. And they've given me that opportunity. I'm so happy for them.
Yay, CSF. All right, we're going to pivot now to another Colorado theater institution, Denver Center. How many seasons have you done with their company now?
I just finished my 21st season at the DCPA.
That's
I know that sounds
epic,
weird.
friend.
I'm
That's
up there.
epic.
That's up there. Yeah, that's what I consider my artistic home. I matriculated through their, they had a actor training program, a Master of Fine Arts program that was attached to the regional theater, that unfortunately is no longer a part of the company that disbanded in 2012. But it was important for me when I was researching graduate schools that they had some relationship to a professional theater. I really wanted to see how that worked. And when they invited me for a call, the callback weekend, they invite like 50 people and they whittle it down to 8 actors. And they said, we're inviting you to do this, and then come see the shows. Come see the facilities, come see Denver. I didn't think I could live in Colorado because I grew up in Texas and it was just gonna be so cold. And then I saw the art and the artistry and the shops and the artisans, right? Not just the actors, the scene shops, the soundscapes, every single designer that's come through this. And then I just fell in love with the bigness of it. And that's what I wanted to be a part of, right? I wasn't going to go. I knew I was too small to even go to New York at that time. I was 21. That was too daunting for me. It's like, I'm not going to go to New York. I think I need more experience. And so I did that. And so I matriculated through that program, met a one lot of wonderful individuals through that, and then just have maintained my relationship with the Denver Center. And I say it's my artistic home because, yes, I cut my teeth there as a student, but they've also given me so many opportunities beyond school to continue to grow. And that continues to happen. I'm very grateful to continue to have those relationships. I jokingly say I've survived 3 artistic directors, but I've been there for so long that, I was there when Donovan Marley was artistic director. I was there when Kent Thompson was artistic director, and now Chris Coleman's artistic director. And thankfully, I've continued to foster those relationships. It's important. Everybody says theater is such a cutthroat business. I said, well, it is a business, and I think you create what type it is for you. It can be cutthroat or it can be fruitful. It really is how you navigate that. Not that there you have bouts of both, but I think the fostering of what we do is so important. The networking of what we do is so important. And it's just not the work that's being created. I love going out to a coffee or going to having a cocktail with another artist and just talking about the artistry is so important. I think that's what we do after the show, right? We go out to the bars after we've done a show, and we continue to talk about the artistry. I find that fascinating. But yeah, I've had a long tenure here in Denver. A lot of people are so surprised at this is where I call home base. But I think it's also really, for a long time, it was called, Denver's best kept secret. Our market is while healthy, it's still small and attainable, but now it's getting competitive. There's a lot of people who want to work here. There's a lot of people who want to move here just because of the lifestyle. You know, the Colorado, it's just gorgeous. It's a gorgeous state to live in. So the talent pool is getting really, really quite interestingly big here and competitive, and I love that. Because it keeps everyone kind of on their toes, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I love that you shared that you had enough self-awareness as a young theater artist to know like New York isn't for me right now, because I think that narrative gets is the overarching one. And like my junior year of undergrad, I got to have a semester in residence at a small regional theater in Minnesota. I don't know if you know Hal Kropp or Kristen Underwood, but Hal Kropp was the is the artistic director of the Commonweal Theater. He also went through the National Conservatory, but probably not at the same time as you. But spend some time working physically at a regional theater if you can, like in an apprenticeship, in whatever.
Internship, anything,
Check that
anything.
that's the thing you want to do, because I think folks have a perception of what working in theater is, and there can be a really big culture shock from whatever your specific high school theater teacher was to whoever you experience in undergrad. Those are so such siloed experiences. So like I think we've lost this thread of the idea of an apprenticeship. And so if you're able to work that able to make that work as a young theater artist, I cannot recommend that enough.
Yeah, and research those programs because they're out there. I mean, relationships between professional theaters and educational institutions, I think it's kind of growing. I think it's more attractive. And I think that's great because, you know, I'm now at a point where I'm teaching the next generation of actors, and somehow we've skipped that information of there's many paths to this. There's many gateways to this, and that's just one, right? It's like, all right, yes, you can go to New York and you can cut your teeth and you can hit the pavement. But the educational programs are still there. The networking aspect is definitely part of the fibers of the industry, right? I was just, you know, when I was just in Florida, there was a student who saw the show, and they just pinged me on Facebook and said, I would really love to bend your ear. And of course I made time to do that because that's part of the fibers of, you know, I want to pick your brain. I want to be a sponge. I'm still hungry. I'm not satisfied. I want more. Those are all great additional things to have under your belly, right? Other than I want to act. All right. Are you seeing how much theater are you seeing? Are you able to articulate what you liked and what you didn't like? That's what I tell my students a lot. It's like, oh, well, I liked that play. Can you tell me why you liked that play? Can you articulate, can you verbalize? And then hopefully that vernacular and vocabulary can turn internally and say, oh, these are the tools that I have. I say that too. It's like, well, I hated that play. Please tell me why. Can you say why? But networking and mentorship is huge. If you can find that in your communities, or even not, if you see a play and you resonate with an actor on stage and they're on social media, there is nothing wrong with reaching out and saying, I am a young actor. I would love your advice. I would love a 20-minute conversation. It doesn't have to be in person. Look at it. You can do anything on Zoom. You can do anything from your home. It's accessible. Go out there and you know, and grab that extra knowledge that's free.
And you can be, I'm thinking about Leslie Odom Jr.'s memoir and how he was like, I will house manage, I will take tickets, when he was growing up. Like, there are these opportunities to place yourself in the room where it happens, pun intended. But like in Colorado specifically, like you can sign up to be a Henry's judge. Theaters always need volunteers. You don't have to do and one of the best things that I experienced being a Henry's judge or auditor, or I forget the specific title, but it forced me to go to theaters outside of my social network. And so I got to see something at Su Teatro. I got to see something at Creed Repertory. Like, go to the spaces where you're not an expert already, too, I think is important in curating your citizenship, not citizenship. You want to be part of a community. You want to be, theater is so much about those social connections and being a good community member. So yeah, if you're not in a show, that happens to the best of us. That happens to everyone. Go see a bunch of shows then. Like, sign up, volunteer, do the things. Like, it's
That
so important.
truly is. That truly is. Volunteerism is not only great, but not only does it help the theater, but you go usher, and then you get to see free theater or go see go see live theater because it can add up. I mean, let's be honest, it's not cheap, but there's ways and avenues to get to see theater. Invited dress rehearsals. Contact a theater and say, I'd love, before you open a show, are your rehearsals open? Are you inviting, are your dress rehearsals open? Can we come see that? I don't have the deep pockets. You're a major regional theater. There's just ask. You can DM me in my socials and I'll help guide you. I'm totally happy to do that. I don't know other markets. I don't know how Chicago works. I don't know how Atlanta works. But I'm safe to say that volunteerism is probably the best way to get access to that
Absolutely. Before we
free theater
leave
going.
Denver Center, I'm going to take a note from Andy Cohen's Watch What Happens Live. Some of the costumes you have worn, I saw, is it, was it? It wasn't an ideal husband, but it was a title that was very close to that. You are in some very fancy 1940s gear. Which play am I thinking of?
You might have been thinking either The Constant Wife.
That one. Yes.
Okay.
That one. So for me, like, that is your number one costume fit. Like, those costumes were impeccable. Do you have any other, like, if you had to put in your top three costumes that made you feel just so, like, euphoric to wear, what other ones would you throw up on that list?
Any clothing that gets me closer to the character is always attractive. That anything that's tailored to a character, anything that makes me feel like them is always a success. So while I can't currently pinpoint one specific costume, I'm going to say anything that helps me get to the character is going to be really, really crucial. I've worn some beautiful pieces. I've worn some really ornate pieces. And being part of a regional theater is having that relationship with a costume designer where you can say, hey, what if it's also this? This would make me feel like this. Yeah, costume is really important to me. Costume and hair are really
Yeah.
important to me. I always thought I was a transformational actor because I never wanted to play myself. That's we're going into some other, weird psychological areas. But I love affectation. I love the makeup. I love the wigs. I love the costumes because that's what always attracted to me when I was young. It's like I loved fully transforming. And so anything that helps push me to not be or look or sound like Rodney. I just gravitate toward that. Man, do I eat that up. You give me a wig and a palette and a makeup palette and a great costume. Thank you. You've helped me succeed, hopefully. Yeah.
Love it. Tell me about, you've had the opportunity to work with the Old Globe, which is like very high up there in the pantheon of like Shakespearean awesomeness. Tell me about it.
Well, that one, well, it was the Old Globe. It was a new work. I don't know if you were still in town for that, but it was Jose Cruz Gonzalez's American Mariachi is actually the show that I produced that was produced there that I got to travel with. And it was a co-production between the Denver Center and the Old Globe. So that process was interesting only because it was two theaters, two producers, vying for a company that was going to play for about 5 to 6 months. It was a long process. It was also a new work that stemmed out from the New Place Summit. So it was getting its world premiere. So it needed and wanted a lot of time. It wanted a lot of commitment to from actors that were ready to go on that journey. And it was fascinating. As I've gotten older, I've had more, and as the world has evolved too, I've been able to do more work that is culturally mine. that is positively culturally mine. I should also be specific. And to do queer plays because I am a queer artist as well. And for a very long time, those plays were not being produced. And if they were, they weren't showing my communities in a positive light. And so I shied away from that material. Those aren't stories that I want to tell. I want to tell positive stories. I want to tell stories that are impactful and that are not negative towards that. So this was a beautiful piece by Jose Cruz Gonzalez that featured the what would be the first all-female mariachi ensemble. And it was such a powerful female forward musician, musically based play with music. And that was beautiful. The reaction to the audience reaction was just outstanding. I think I remember doing an all Latino community event in Denver, and that I've never played the Apollo, but I feel that's what it must have felt like because it was just an overwhelming response to I am seeing myself on stage. I am seeing my culture on stage. I am listening to Mexican American mariachi music on stage. Like it was like a lot of firsts for a lot of people. And so that was really important. And then we took it to the Old Globe. And that was also such an amazing experience because their border town is Tijuana. I mean, Tijuana is just like 10 minutes away. So the culture is just saturated, the murals, the food. I love San Diego. And so to do that show at the Old Globe and my first introduction to the Old Globe was just so special. Another great theater that has great artisans and leadership, and a theater that is committed to new work. That was really impressive to me. Yeah, I would be back in a heartbeat. And I've continued to have those relationships, right? Like you said, you visit a theater and you try to foster, but one of my favorite people there was the director, James Vasquez, who is one of the associates and just a lovely human. We're still friends to this day. And I'm always interested about the work that they're producing.
Yay! Are you ready, Rodney, for our rapid fire Shakespeare round?
Yes, I didn't want to overthink it, so I just glanced at them and hopefully I don't create too many pauses for your edit.
Whatever emerges is what is meant to emerge.
Heard.
Okay, so what's your favorite Shakespeare play you've directed?
Well, I think currently it would have to be Twelfth Night, only because I think I've been in it so much. It's been easier to unpack than most plays. And so I loved it that I get to go quickly to the why, as opposed to sitting with the play in a very long time. And I've gotten to work with some really great young actors in that play. You say, oh, this fulfills me as an actor. Being fulfilled as a director, when you see your actors succeed and having fun and hitting their moments, that's just, I don't know. I have found that now later in my career that directing has become as fruitful as performing on stage. Just to see the growth in others. I don't know. I'm at that point in my life. I'm at the point in my life. I want to see others succeed. I want others to be happy. I want others to thrive and evolve as artists. It's been really important for me to see the next generation of artists come up.
That reminds me of the Jack Lemmon quote of, it's your responsibility to send the elevator back down. And I think
1,000.
you can do that in a small market, and you can do that, in a Megan Mullally calling Lorne Michaels and making him hire Bill Hader kind of way. Like, there's many things in between. So I love that answer. What is the Shakespeare play you most want to direct?
Ooh, right now, because I think I previously said I'm such a visual person and I love visual, I love music, I love sound. I would love a crack at the Tempest.
Oh, I just
I would
good
love a crack at the
gasped.
Tempest. Yeah, that's when it's the world is already is a magical, mystical world. I can hear the soundscape, I can hear the island. I can hear the storm. I can see the storm. And then it's a really great story of redemption as well, right?
All right, theater world, are you listening? Are you listening? All right, what has been your favorite Shakespearean role to play? to date?
My favorite Shakespearean role. Well, like I said, I've played a lot of clowns. I've done a lot of those, but I can't shy away from that Richard. You know, that Richard was really, really, it was important to me, only if anything, to just define if I could do that type of titular role, right? Did I have that in me to kind of, was I successful? I don't know. I loved doing it. You know, theater is so, you know, it depends on who's receiving the information. But for me as an artist, it was really important for me to do that role. You know, I would say if I loved playing Dogberry. I can't wait to play Dogberry again. I think that's such a great comedic, juicy role. But then I think you also have to stretch yourself and do, you know, if you have opportunities to try to unpack a Hamlet, to unpack a Macker, to unpack a Lear, and in this case, to unpack a Richard, because you know, I hope you're never satisfied as an artist. I never am. I'm consistently hungry. I'm consistently wanting to know the why, and Richard offered me that opportunity. So I think that's just selfishly, it was my favorite because it made me work really, really hard on the type of work that, you know, you say, well, I'm a Shakespearean actor. Well, what does that mean? I hope what that means for me is that I'm able to continue attack the material the way I would in any other one. But yeah, but with a lot of meat on the bone. And that had a lot of meat on the bone.
Do you have a specific bucket list? Oh, I've got to tread the boards and play this role. I haven't gotten the chance to do it yet.
Well, as I've aged through Shakespeare, and have kind of had passes on, you know, some of the really good younger to middle age roles. I mean, for me now, it's not going to happen anytime soon, but I am so looking forward to playing a Prospero. I am so looking forward to hopefully being considered as a King Lear. I mean, we're talking hopefully, you know, 10, 15 years from now, hopefully. But those are the roles that I'm opining for now, right? It's those older Shakespearean characters, which, you know, I'm clipping at their heels, friend.
What favorite fight scene? And it could either be one that you've been in or one that you've watched.
So, yeah, this one turns out to be, it's not Shakespeare, but it's classical. If you're saying fight scene, not Shakespeare fight scene. I did a Three Musketeers a few years ago that had 12 fight scenes on a rotating stage with elevators. This was just an amazing playground to work on. And I was one of the Three Musketeers was playing Porthos. And so you, if you were a Three Musketeer and you were D'Artagnan, you were in every single fight you were in. And so I was in the best shape of my life, but it was also the most beautiful work because I got to work again with a rapier, which I hadn't worked with a lot. Right, in Shakespeare, it's broadsword and quarterstaff and swords, but the rapier is such a beautiful weapon to work with. That for me was just, it was really, really nice to get back to. But it was also big. 12 fights. Our fight call, I think, was like 40 minutes to get through it all. But and beautiful too. It was beautiful that I believe it was Tony Samotes, who was an original member at Shakespeare and Company. This was back in Florida, who helped design those fights for us. Just gorgeous, just gorgeous. That was my favorite to this
Wow.
day.
Love it. Favorite death scene?
Of mine or that I've seen, is that correct?
Whichever answer floats to the top first is the correct one.
My favorite death scene. Ooh. Oh, I think I'm going to say Polonius. I think Polonius was my favorite death scene, only because I got to die, but I also had to stay on stage dead. But I also got to work with a wonderful actress, our female Hamlet at CSF, and I think, but she used me as a dead body. It was amazing, and you know, there was shadow, you know, there was light and shadow where I got stabbed, and I got pulled onto stage, and then she basically used me as a piece of, you know, a slab of meat, and just using my character in there. I think that was great. I've died a lot. I've died a lot on stage, but I think that only in the way the body was manipulated to help tell the story, right?
We love to see it. So you may have already answered this with Dogberry, but who is your favorite Shakespearean clown?
Oh, I love them all. I love them all, and I have it, and there's still a few that I haven't touched yet. I would say Dogberry's up there. Trinculo's pretty fun. Trinculo's pretty fun. When you can play Shakespeare and then also be a little, and that they also are drunks on stage, or I'd say drunks, they're happily inebriated. Are fun. And then some days there's characters who aren't necessarily clowns. There was an Oberon that I did that I kind of squeezed out a little bit more physicality than what we think the Oberon kind of is. And that was where costumes helped me. I was basically like a Misfits David Bowie Oberon, which already, open up that toolbox. That just helped. I'm gonna say Trinculo, Dogberry, probably top of my list.
So, if you had to choose a play for someone to experience as their first Shakespearean play, which play are you going to send them to?
That's a good question. I would say, I think I would introduce them maybe into a Much Ado, maybe a Comedy of Errors, and then slowly start to increase the needle with the histories and the romances and stuff. I think you don't want to daunt, you don't want to have somebody and sit through Henry VIII as their first Shakespeare play, right? It's dense, it's rhetoric, it's poetry. And while we know we love it and it's important, I think you want to hook that person first. And I think the thing's going to be with the comedy. It's going to be with constantly being questioned, like anything with twins in it. It's always fascinating. It's like, oh, this, no, this, no, this. This is funny because they think this person is this. You know what I mean? Anything that can activate the audience while they're watching, I think, is important. Accessibility. Let's get them excited about what they're seeing and then challenge them.
An apt strategy, methinks. All right, our final question is through magic, maybe Prospero's magic, you get an hour to sit down and talk with Shakespeare himself, but you can only discuss one play. Which play do you
Yeah.
want to pick his brain about?
I think it would have to be Hamlet.
Yeah.
Hamlet for me is fascinating. I've done the show quite a lot, but I've always been fascinated about the actor that's unpacking Hamlet. And so I just love being in the room and going, what are they bringing from their personal lives to deal with that? And so I've seen a lot of great people unpack their Hamlet, and they're all very different. But I would want to sit down with him and talk about, we think historians say, this was born out of, the plays are written about the death of his son Hamnet, and this that was kind of the catalyst, and that, he writes about a lot of grieving in the play. There's a lot of death in the play. As humans, I think that's the one common denominator. We've all lost a loved one. We've all have grieved in various forms, a pet, parent, loved one, people in our communities, neighbors. And so I would want to talk about his why, about and how grieving and death was the catalyst for him. They all are, Gertrude is somewhat grieving her husband, and she's using this to distract her, right? Ophelia is grieving her father. Hamlet's grieving his father. Just the idea of death and how we navigate that is just fascinating to me. And I think that to me is the more psychological, the how and how it got to paper would be my biggest question. And who wouldn't want to sit down with Shakespeare?
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yes. It's an interesting thought exercise. So we have come to the end of our time together, Rodney. This has been a very joyful conversation. Can you share out any projects you're able to share about that are coming up? And if folks want to connect with you further, how do they find you online?
Sure. I'm currently performing in a play called What the Constitution Means to Me by Heidi Schreck at my theater company in Boulder, Boulder Ensemble Theater Company. We're currently playing until February 11th at the Savoy. I have a short, brief stint, and then I get to do a bucket list comedy called Noises Off at the Arvada Center, and that will play through May 5th.
What are you playing? Can I ask?
I'm playing Freddie, nosebleeding Freddie. And let me tell you, I've been following that show. I'm so happy it's finally gotten on my lap. It's one of those, top tier comedy, physical comedy. It's everything that I think I feel I'm good at. So we'll see if I succeed. So yes, Boulder Ensemble Theater Company.org and arvadacenter.org for tickets and information. And then you can, if you'd like to reach out to me, I am on Instagram and Facebook at Rodney Liscano.
I think there's very, very little left to say. So thank you so much, Rodney. I wish you nothing but the best. Go see Noises Off, y'all. Check out all the cool things that are happening in Colorado because chances are Rodney's going to be a part of it in some way. Thank you so much.
I hope to. Shout out to you, my friend. Colorado misses you, by the way. We know everyone grows and has to leave, but please know that your presence is definitely missed in these parts.
Well, shucks, Rodney. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host and producer, Woodzik. This podcast is distributed by American Theater Magazine, and this episode was edited by Travis Rosemary Kerhard-Fischbach. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you back here next month for more interviews with artists and cultural trailblazers.